storm. Pacers are up 2-0. Now the forecast from the National Weather Service today, partly sunny and warm, a high of 69 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. This morning, wind northeast at 8, 61 Kenosha, 58 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Whenever I am asked if I have a favorite interview out of the thousands of interviews I have recorded for the morning show over the past three decades, I always respond that my single favorite interview was the one I recorded back in 2002 with Alexandra Zabruder, author and editor of a truly extraordinary book called Salvaged Pages, Young Writer's Diaries of the Holocaust. I want to replay a portion of that interview today in honor of Holocaust Remembrance Day. These 15 diaries are somewhat comparable to the single most famous diary to emerge out of the Holocaust, that of Anne Frank.
Anne Frank wrote her diary while she was in hiding in Holland, and she... I'm not going to get the exact dates right. I think it's 1942 to 1944. And then in 1944, in August of 1944, the Frank family was arrested in the hiding place where they had been for more than 2 years. And Anne Frank left the diary behind. As I recall, it was on the floor of the hiding place, and it was overlooked by the guards or the police who came to arrest the family. And it was picked up by one of the people who had been sheltering the Frank family and kept in her care until Otto Frank, who was the only surviving member of the family and of all of the people who had been in the hiding place, when he came back after the war, she gave, this is Miep Guess, who then gave the diary to Mr. Frank. So that is sort of the story of the saving of the diary, and then, of course, it has a long publication history.
That's one of the most interesting things you recount, how the book was, the diary, that is, was first published in Holland, then in France, and then an American writer, Meyer Levin, mm-hmm. comes across it. And it is, in large measure, a powerful review of the diary, which he writes, that was published in the New York Times Book Review, that really helped set the stage for that diary's extraordinary impact on the American public. But you talk about how, in some ways, Mr. Levin's enthusiasm for the diary and the way it was received by many, in some ways was misguided or distorted the way in which a diary like that of Anne Frank should be read. Explain to us how that diary was, for whatever laudable reasons, sort of mishandled or misunderstood.
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting story because Meyer Levin, I think, was himself a very searching and honest and genuine person. And he really wanted to communicate to Americans in particular the horror of the Holocaust and what had taken place in Europe in the 1930s and 40s. But when he encountered Anne Frank's diary, I think as so many people have since, he was so overwhelmed by the immediate feeling that it created in him, the sense that this young writer was still present in the world and that she sort of lived on through the power of her writing, that was the framework in which he presented it to the American people, that the great gift of the diary was that through it we could come to know Anne Frank through the intimate details of her life and her extraordinary way of expressing herself in this wonderful immediate feeling that is indeed captured in the diary, that we could come to know her, and that then we could remember her, and it would be as if she never died at all, as if we could in some way rectify the great wrong that was done to her, and by extension to all of the Jews of Europe, by allowing her to live on inside our hearts. And I think it's a very understandable feeling, and it's an understandable approach, in particular given the fact that it was the 1950s and attitudes and mores were so different than they are now. But the damage in terms of the American perception of the Holocaust, I think, was that it gave us a way out of confronting the very serious consequences of genocide. Instead of thinking that this was a diary that reminded us of what was lost in the Holocaust, it was used to help us imagine that something could be retained, that a life could be saved, even though genocide had taken place. Does that make sense?
Yeah, very much so. Okay. And you talk about how, in other cases too, it's not just the diary of Anne Frank, but other children's diaries that were published in those early years were treated in very much the same way. And you quote reviews or introductions or prefaces in some of these other diaries in which it was said that, for instance, in one case, this diary, by publishing it, allows the readers to witness the resurrection of Louise.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as one reads her words, she vanquishes death and overcomes time. And you're saying that's simply not true, and it does not tell the story properly.
That's right. I think it's a wishful thought. I mean, there's nothing in the world. That's the whole message of the introduction, I think, is to encourage us to look honestly and with clear eyes at the consequences of genocide, and to look at these fragments and say, there is nothing in the world that can allow the resurrection of a person who lost his or her life. And in the case of genocide, that was a crime that was committed, and there is no framework that we can adopt that will make it all better. You know, and not only that, but it's dishonest in a way, and it's really sort of putting our own emotional comfort in front of the truth of the situation. And I think the important thing about the reviews that I quoted in the introduction and the passages from the other introductions of other diaries, the point really is to say that this framework that Meyer Levin created became so prevalent and so common that in a way we ceased to even question it. It became the absolute truth about other diaries that followed Anne Frank's diary, so that every diary that was ever published had that same message about it, that because it was a diary, it must be personal and private, and therefore we could come to know the writer, and therefore that writer would live on. And for me, when I began doing this research, and I kept seeing this language over and over and over again, something simply didn't ring true. It didn't match up with the experience then of reading these diaries and feeling this great loss, that here was this wonderful, powerful literary voice that had been silenced. And so that sort of gap or that disconnect is what led me to start looking into this and examining it and thinking about whether or not there was another framework that would make more sense for this material.
Right. You say at one point that you can't possibly really know somebody just from the words that they write. I mean, that does a disservice to Anne Frank, that the very notion that we could know her as a vibrant, complex human being just by reading her diary entries. It's simply not possible.
Right, and I think the best example of that is for people to think of their own lives and to think of what it would be like if someone found 50 or 100 or even 200 pages of your own personal writing and tried from that to reconstruct an understanding of who you are. It's so paltry and so small when you put it in the context of a whole life. And yes, in the case of Anne Frank and in the case of many of these other diarists, it's all we have. And, you know, I, for one, am grateful that we have those fragments, but I don't think that they're to be confused with a whole life. It seems very unfair to make it extend or read into it all of the complexity of an entire human person.
And, of course, you bring up quite rightly that not only have people done that, but they have also drawn the diary's significance still further to say that somehow Anne Frank, in her words, speaks for all those thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Jewish children that lost their lives in the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And you point out quite rightly that that too is not possible.
Mm-hmm. It's an extension of the exact same thing. It's as if from a fragmentary set of pages you could extrapolate a life, and then from one life you could extrapolate a generation. And again, I think it goes to that desire to rectify the damage, to imagine that there's something that we could do or something that we could say or imagine that would make it as if this never happened. So Anne Frank speaks for the millions of children who perished, when in fact the important thing is Anne Frank's diary barely speaks for herself, let alone for all of those young people who lost their lives.
Nobody can speak for
right.
them.
The important thing is that no one can speak for them. That's what genocide is.
One of the things you say so beautifully in your introduction to this point of why we are tempted to look at these diaries in a certain way, you say it implies once again that the value we have traditionally placed on them, meaning the diaries, does not stem from what they actually describe, recount, or suggest, but that it grows from what we wish or want them to be.
Yes. I mean, I think the new, I think the different framework that I wanted to suggest about this material is that instead of reading into a diary, for example, the Diary of Anne Frank, what we wish it would be, exactly that we wish that Anne Frank could live on and we wish that she could speak for all of the children and bring them back, and we wish that she could somehow redeem humanity for the evil that was done, that instead of thinking of it that way, we might look at the diary itself and think, what did she say that might change the way we understand this history? What information, both historical and literary, is contained within it that can deepen the way we understand this history? And for me, that is the most sort of clear-sighted and respectful way of looking at the material. It's looking at it for what it actually is and giving these young writers their due for having made a serious contribution to the historical and literary record of this period under circumstances that were extraordinarily difficult and dangerous.
Right. And they, of course, each of these young writers are talking about their own lives, their own experience, and that of their families and perhaps their friends. And by trying to transfer it into sort of a universal scope, we lose sight of those precious little details which mm-hmm. they tell about their own experience and what happened to them and their families.
Exactly. And I think the thing about the material that at least I found to be so compelling is that there's a great deal that we know about the Holocaust, but these diaries have a way of helping, in a way, making it more complicated or helping us to see the complexity in things that we think we already know. For example, the example that always springs to my mind is we know, of course, that people were extraordinarily hungry during the Holocaust and that they died of starvation in just staggering numbers. But there are diaries and several that come to mind in which the details of a life lived while dying of starvation and the sort of daily complexity of that life is so powerfully revealed. Everything from standing in line for rations or making lists of amounts of food or the breakdown of communities and family members and the calculating and counting of how much food there is, the physical suffering of hunger, the emotional anxiety, all of those composite parts that make up one day or one week or one month in the life of a person who's dying of starvation. That information is incredibly powerful and rich and meaningful if one wants to understand this history.
Another example that comes to mind from what I've read of the book is we are given a very vivid sense of the chaos and fear that surrounded so many of these families as war approached, mm-hmm. as many of these families sought to leave Germany and time again would find the road literally blocked by bureaucracy and they would chase from office to office or chase after hope of mm-hmm. of maybe we can move here, maybe we can move there. And time and again, those hopes and plans and dreams turning to ashes.
Mm-hmm.
And and you, as you read the diary and entry after entry, you start to get a very vivid sense of that terrible chapter, which isn't even the chapter that involves perhaps, you know, losing one's life, but just living in that perpetual state of fear and bewilderment and literally not knowing what was going to come next.
The first diary in the book, the diary of Klaus Langer, is the perfect example of that. This young boy who was writing in Essen in Germany, and that's exactly, I mean, the way you described it is exactly what's recounted in the diary. And I always think about the names of the countries that are sort of rattled off as possible options, all of which fall through. He talks about Argentina and America, of course, and India, Peru, the Dominican Republic, Uruguay, Palestine, Shanghai, and every place ends up being a dead end. And it's, you know, again, that's about details. It's one thing to know that people couldn't get out. It's another thing to read along as the most creative solutions are sought and nothing ever works.
Right. It's one thing to know that that happened to people, but somehow we live it, or we get a sense of what it was like to actually be caught in that kind of awful situation. We're speaking today with Alexandra Zeebruder. She is the editor of an extraordinary book called Salvaged Pages, Young Writers' Diaries of the Holocaust. If we can remain with the introduction just a little bit longer, you tell us about how the assemblage of these diary excerpts into this book really worked in three phases. And, of course, it began by trying to gather information about these diaries and then to actually gather examples of them for you to actually use. I wonder if you could take us through that process by which you came to know about more of these diaries and found yourself able to use them.
In the beginning, when I sort of conceived of the idea to do this project, initially I thought that there would be, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 diaries in the book. I didn't ever imagine that I would know about 55 or 60 of them. It never even occurred to me that there could be so many of them. But I began to read as much as I could about young people in the Holocaust and about the Holocaust in general, and I sort of in an informal way started accumulating references to diaries. You know, I would be reading something and there would be a quote from a diary or a reference to a diary or a footnote about a diary, and I found myself with these lists of names of young people who had allegedly kept diaries. So the initial phase was one of research, in which I gathered these names of people and went to the publishers or the writers or historians or scholars or museums or archives or wherever in order to try to get a copy of the diary in the original language or in whatever language it existed. And so that was sort of the first phase. And then the second phase was getting the material translated into English, because there did come a certain point when I understood that I would never be able to make any assertions about the body of material unless I was able to read as much of it as possible and to really survey it in some kind of comprehensive way. So I raised quite a lot of grant money, thanks to the generosity of a number of truly wonderful people, hired a number of translators who were working in all different languages. The diaries themselves were written in all the languages of Europe, and had the material translated into English. And as the material came to me, I began reading it again and again and again, and trying to see what the big themes were and what the commonalities were and distinctions and what emerged from the body of material. And then, of course, there was the process of putting it together in a book, at choosing which diaries would be in the book, editing them, and doing all of the research that was required to introduce them to the public. So those were sort of the broad phases. It was really a broad gathering in the beginning, and then gradually culling through it and narrowing it down so that it could take some form that people could digest.
A couple of questions come to mind, or points. One of them is that you mentioned in the whole phase of translation that in at least a few cases, these young writers were fluent in more than one language and utilized more than one language within the body of a single diary.
Mm-hmm.
which, of course, complicates the whole process of translation.
Yes, one of them, the most complicated diary, and I had a wonderful translator for it, but the most complicated diary from that point of view was one that was written in the Lodz Ghetto in Poland in 1944, and it was written in four different languages. Now, one of the languages was English, so at least that one wasn't such a problem, but the other languages were Yiddish, Polish, and Hebrew. So I needed to find a person who was fluent in all of those languages and who could render the text into English. So there were challenges, and then there were other cases in which, for example, a diarist might have been writing in Yiddish, for example, in Lithuania, and there would be Lithuanian words sort of scattered throughout, and the translator might not necessarily know Lithuanian. So sometimes I had to pull people in order to help uncover certain kinds of mysteries. But in general, the translators were extremely knowledgeable about the history of the Holocaust and about European culture or the culture of the language, the country that they were translating from. And so they were able to figure out nuances or explain things away that I would never have been able to understand. So they really fulfilled multiple roles. In some cases, they were doing research for me as well as translating the diaries.
What about the whole issue of legibility, the fact that we are probably talking about, in many cases, diaries that were written down under less than ideal situations, settings, and so on? First of all, what kind of form did the diaries take by the time your translators were working with them? Or were they working from facsimiles of the original written diaries, or had by that point had they been typed out? And to what extent was that a difficult process in and of itself?
It depended on the situation. I mean, it's a great question because it sort of, I mean, it was such a complicated process. In some cases, we were working from Xeroxed copies or, you know, photocopies of the original diary. And in some cases, for example, in the case of Klaus Langer's diary, he wrote in the Gothic form of German, which isn't really used anymore, but it's not a form that everyone knows. And so that poses its own set of problems, but and then in other cases, translators were working from typescripts. So, for example, a diary, an original diary, might have ended up in an archive, and someone somewhere along the line made a typescript of it so that it could be preserved on microfilm or for whatever reason, and that was obviously preferable because it's a little easier to work with. And in terms of the handwriting, sometimes it was very difficult, and there are some parts of the diaries that are just illegible, and there's really nothing to be done about it. It really depended. And then there were other problems that came up. For example, sometimes there were diaries that, there was one diary that was written originally in Hungarian and had been translated into Hebrew and then translated into English. And the original Hungarian diary had been lost. So the sort of closest generation to the original was itself a translation. Now, it turned out that diary didn't need to be retranslated for the book. I didn't end up using it, but that's the kind of situation that could occur. You know, and in a perfect world, what any translator wants, I think, is to work from the original or whatever is closest to the original, including the handwritten, because that's the way to capture the flavor of the diary best. If you're already working from another generation, mistakes can be made, or there's always the interpretation of whoever translated it in the intermediate stage.
Of course. You just touched on what I think is a point of maybe exquisite complexity, and that is choosing what diaries to excerpt for the purposes of this book.
Mm-hmm.
I think, first of all, that must have been so painful in a sense, because it's not like you were assembling a book of photos of Elvis Presley or something, and there's only room for 70 of them, and we're just going to leave out these other 50, although it would be fun to include them. We're not talking about that at all. We are talking about precious words from innocent victims. And I'm sure there was a part of you that could discard, in a sense, these certain diaries. I would think with a real sense of regret.
Mm-hmm. It was. I mean, I think that's quite right. And it's interesting because in some ways, I kept having to reprimand myself. You know, here, the whole message of the book is that these diaries are not, they don't equal lives, and that I'm not rescuing these young writers, and that nothing can be done. And yet, there is that emotional feeling that somehow those writers whose diaries are reprinted in the book are somehow going to be known and remembered in a different way. And so in some ways I felt that very deeply, and it was extremely difficult, especially when it you know, there were sort of 20 diaries that were really in the, and they were the 20 that I wanted to use, and I had to cut 15 I had to cut 5 or 6, and those were the most difficult choices. And I used to lie on the floor of my study and just look up at the ceiling and sort of talk myself through it, you know, and try to be as rational as possible and think, you know, there's a reason to include this one versus that one, or there's a, you know, and try to make the right choices. But it was extremely difficult, and it took a long time every time I had to face the fact that another one needed to be, you know, cut from the collection. It was sort of a 2 or 3 week process from the dawning of the idea to the actual acceptance of it. So that was definitely difficult.
I would be curious to know what kinds of things weighed in that process of making the choices of what to include here. I know that you worked very hard for this to be a variety of diaries and writers, and yet you say very clearly that in no way can they be fully representative of that whole lost generation.
Mm-hmm.
You also point out specifically in your introduction that some of these writers were clearly more talented in their craft than others. I mean,
mm-hmm.
some of these were gifted writers like Anne Frank, and others were not, but that was not necessarily the defining criteria for you. I don't think it was. Anyway.
No, it wasn't. It was really about the shape of the book, and it's in any creative process, it takes a long time, I think, to gain a sense of what it is that you're trying to do. And so there were some of the criteria, of course, were, you know, is the material compelling in one way or another? Does it shed some light on this history? Is it interesting from a literary point of view, even if it's not necessarily beautifully written? Is there still something that can be said about its literary power, something that it evokes or suggests? So, of course, each diary that went into the book had to meet that criteria, and there were many, many, many diaries that met that criteria that did not go in the book. And sometimes the decision was something like the diaries from Poland, you know, that reflect life in a ghetto, and I can't just, it's going to weight it too heavily in one type of experience, and I want to have something from someone in hiding, or I want to have something from a refugee. Or so there were a lot of different criteria that, in order to make it as broad as possible and as representative as possible from a geographical standpoint, from the standpoint of historical experience, in terms of literary style. But, you know, it was ultimately a very personal set of choices. You know, at a certain point, the book began to take a shape, and it just made sense. Some things made sense in the book, and other things didn't make sense anymore.
There is the inclusion of a couple of appendices. The first appendix is actually a list
mm-hmm.
You call Young Diarists of the Holocaust. And I don't remember now if in that list are included those diarists that you use in this book. I'm just looking carefully.
No, actually, the way that we did it, that appendix was my only sort of solace for the diaries that didn't make it into the book, because the point of that appendix was to provide a survey of every single diary of the entire body of material and include a paragraph description of every diary that I knew about. In the case of the diaries that are excerpted in the book, they're there, but it says see chapter, you know, 4 or whatever it is. But that appendix is, I think, the most complete survey, to my knowledge, that exists of the body of material as a whole.
You make mention of the fact, too, that there is presumably still more material out there someplace. There may be at least a handful of other diaries that have not yet come to light.
Mm-hmm. I suspect that that's true, and in fact, some have already started to come to light, not surprisingly, as a consequence of this work. And one wonderful thing that happened is that I was a guest curator for an exhibition about these diaries in Houston, which was called Private Writings, Public Records, and we brought 8 original original diaries from all over the world to Houston, and artwork and photographs and other things. And in the course of that research, it turned out that there was a Holocaust survivor in Houston who had a diary that he kept as a young boy in Europe. So, you know, in some ways, and so that is a diary that was, it was too late to include it in the book, but it's one that I already know of, and there are others that are coming to light, and hopefully if there's ever a new edition of this book, they'll be able to be added.
You also make mention at some point, I think in the introduction, of the fact that there are certainly cases in which a family, for whatever reason, does not feel emotionally comfortable with having a diary in their possession published or released to the world.
Mm-hmm. In some cases, it wasn't so much, it wasn't usually family members or friends, because I think in the case of the writer who perished, the person who became the guardian of the diary was often, most people were really delighted and moved that anyone would be interested and you know, very sort of supportive of the idea and encouraging. But there were individual people who were survivors who had diaries that they didn't want to share. And in some cases, it was because they felt that there was a great deal of private material. In other cases, for example, there are diaries that are included in the book that were edited first by the writer. That is, the survivor sent me the parts of the diary that I was allowed to see. Mm. And there might be parts that were would be hurtful to people who were alive that that person wanted to keep back. But most of the time, interestingly, most of the time the reluctance that I encountered among people who had diaries was that they thought their diaries wouldn't be interesting or relevant. They were basically embarrassed. And they thought, you know, these are just the things that I wrote as a little girl, and how could they mean anything? And it really took getting the material, putting it in the context of other young writers' diaries, for that person to be able to see that indeed it does have a historical value. So there were some people who were reluctant in the beginning and who eventually came around.
But who didn't understand how it could be significant.
Right, and who just, you know, right. They didn't, and I think one of the things that a very close friend of mine said to me once, and I always remembered it, he said, you know, one of the amazing things, he's a writer, his name is Michael Downing, and he said to me that one of the things that so struck him is that there were all of these people, when Anne Frank's diary came out and it was so famous and there was so much noise about it, that there were all these people who had diaries, who were Holocaust survivors and had diaries in their possession, and they didn't think that their diaries were like her diary. They never sort of said, well, I have a diary too. My diary is like her diary. It was as if people had the tendency to think that their diaries had no value. And most of the Holocaust survivors that I worked so closely with really didn't see, where they were sort of bemused by my interest in the beginning, and they thought, you know, they couldn't understand how this could constitute a really significant body of material.
I suppose part of it is maybe takes us back to that veneration of the Anne Frank diary.
Yes.
That if it is elevated onto this pedestal, then other diarists would feel like they didn't have those same gifts, or their story wasn't in the same way compelling, perhaps.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I think that what then ended up happening as a consequence of that is that any other diary that was published or that came to light was exactly that. It was another diary. There was the Anne Frank diary, and then there was everything else. And every other diary got measured against that standard.
Hmm.
And what I really wanted to do in this book was not only sort of put Anne Frank's diary in the context of its genre, put all of these diaries together, but to say there's a different framework for looking at this material in which it's all valuable. It has a historical relevance. It has literary significance. It's all relevant. It's not about whose diary makes us feel the most like that person survived, or whose diary gives us redemptive language for thinking about the Holocaust.
We probably at this point maybe should clarify some of what we have said thus far about the Anne Frank diary, that I don't think this discussion, there is any intention to diminish its importance or significance or its beauty.
Mm-hmm. No, certainly not.
But that it needs to be appreciated in proper context.
Right. I mean, I've always said, you know, to myself that, you know, I think Anne Frank's diary is extraordinary. I'd love to read Anne Frank's diary. And I think she was indeed an extraordinarily gifted writer. And I think the wealth of detail in her diary evokes as vividly, if not more vividly, than many, the character of daily life in hiding. It's certainly, I have nothing against her diary, quite to the contrary. I think what I have always wanted to be able to say in this book is that the framework that was imposed upon it is one that is we've outgrown. It's not even a framework that is morally wrong or bad or evil, or people should be, you know, put in jail for having thought about it the way that they did. It's just that it reflected another time. It reflected America in the 1950s, and it's now, you know, 2002, and it's time for, like so many things, it's time to rethink it and look at it in a new light. And part of the way that we can do that is not just by looking at, not just by presenting a new framework for thinking about the material, but also looking at all of the material that exists at the same time.
I want to ask you also about the second appendix in the book, which you call At the Margins. What is that about?
It's about the body of material that relates to this particular genre, but that isn't exactly in it. So the way I would describe it is that when I began searching for young writers' diaries, I had to cast a very, very wide net in order to try to find things. And quite often it would happen that someone would say to me, oh, I know of a diary, and I would get it in the mail, and it would turn out that it was not a diary. It was, in fact, a memoir, or it was a diary that had been, an original diary had been lost, and the person had rewritten it. Or it would be, somebody would say, I've heard of, you know, a diary, look this up, this name, and it would turn out that it was a diary written by a non-Jewish youngster. Or there would be a diary of a person who wrote, but she was 28 or 30. And so what I ended up wanting to do was to, because I felt that the singular popularity of Anne Frank's diary had meant that this body of material had never really been defined as a genre on its own terms, that was part of the task. Who are the young people who are included here? What constitutes a diary, and what do we mean when we say Holocaust versus World War II? But then to look at the body of material that came very close to it, the writings of non-Jewish youngsters, the writings of older people, and the diaries or diary memoirs or sort of quasi-diaries that came to light that couldn't most properly be defined as a diary but still had something in common with the body of material. That's the purpose of that study.
That distinction is an interesting one to me, the distinction between a diary and a memoir. I wonder if you would give us your sense of the respective value of each, of a diary versus a memoir. Mm-hmm. Maybe define them first and then explain what you think their respective significances are.
A diary, at least as I've defined it in this book, is a narrative account written at the time of the Holocaust in this case, usually with sort of periodic dated entries. But the most important thing about it is that it's written at the time as events occur. And, of course, the great value of a diary is that that type of daily or weekly reporting allows for a close-up view of events and allows for an accumulation of detail that is extremely powerful and significant when trying to understand the nuances of a particular moment in time. A memoir is something, a narrative often, that was written after events occurred. So it recaps something that occurred in the past. And the value of a memoir is that there is perspective. One can frame one story in a completely different way rather than it having a kind of daily linear quality in which the beginning and the end are not clearly defined and you don't know what's going to happen. In a memoir, the story has already occurred and it has a shape, and that whole shape is reflected in the writing. So they're different. And they're, in the case of this body of material, there are a great many young people who wrote diaries and whose diaries were lost, or parts of their diaries were lost, and they rewrote them either to the best of their ability from memory, or they took notes at the time and then amplified them after after the war was over, after they were free. And so they have this kind of middle quality. And still, the material is extremely valuable. It's just different because it has, it's layered with perspective that one, and also with knowledge of the outcome, which one doesn't have when one is writing a diary.
Right. I think that's one of the really interesting things in the first couple of diaries that I've had the chance to read, that of Klaus Langer, and then the second, which is a young woman writing.
Elizabeth Kaufman.
Yes, Elizabeth Kaufman. That in both cases, they as is the case, I suppose, with many of these diarists, they come from rather well-to-do backgrounds and live quite idyllic, privileged lives. And the way you have presented them, we are given at least a certain number of entries from those days when life is rosy, and then bit by bit, and they maybe don't even realize at the time that life is beginning to change, and then in some cases, climactically, traumatically, life changes in an instant.
Mm-hmm.
And in a memoir, you would have this sort of literary shape that things are building up to this, and in these cases with these diaries, we're given a sense of how abruptly life can change.
Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, Primo Levi wrote so beautifully about survivor testimonies and memoirs and about the sort of stylized, sometimes the stylized quality of a memoir that you sort of feel it coming, you know, because you know when you're reading a memoir about the Holocaust, for example, you know that the happy life in the beginning is a prelude to things changing. Obviously, that's what's going to happen.
And it's described thus.
Exactly. And it's a counterpoint to the horrible things that are going to happen. But in the case of some of these diaries, it doesn't, because they were simply writing about their lives without knowing that this life that they were describing was going to be a thing of the past, it's not romanticized in any particular way. It's not necessarily even particularly rosy. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. It really has the quality of life as we live it. That, you know, yes, we live in freedom, and yes, we live in peace, but life has its ups and downs, and good things happen, and then bad things happen. And so it's a little more measured in that way. And then we, as the reader, then you sort of bump up against a change, and you don't necessarily see it coming because the writer didn't see it coming.
Right, exactly. I think, again, of the Klaus Langer diary, where he talks about that awful night known as Kristallnacht, or Crystal Night, when there had been an assassination, and then the Nazis respond to it with a really shocking outbreak of vandalism across Austria, directed towards Jews there. And he describes that in really shocking, searing detail, and clearly did not see that coming.
Right. I mean, and it happened in both in Austria and in Germany. And I think, and Klaus, exactly as you say, no one really saw it coming. I mean, that's the thing about sort of one of the things about these diaries, in particular, those that recapture a little bit of life in the 1930s. From the moment that Hitler took power in 1933, yes, many, many, many things changed between 1933 and 38, but the changes were incremental. And it sort of goes to the human tendency to normalize the circumstances and to try to say, well, it's a bad thing, but it's not going to get any worse, or, well, we can live with things being this way, and to get lulled into accepting increasing and escalating restrictions. And Kristallnacht was so violent and so sudden in a way and so extreme that it really was like a warning bell. And I think that's very clearly captured in Klaus's diary, because he's so shocked and stunned by this, the burning of the synagogue and the youth organization and the damage to his own home and the fact that they stay up all night hearing the sounds of the stormtroopers and they're, you know, very much afraid, of course, for their own safety. And that really marks a dramatic turning point in the diary, after which nothing is the same.
Right. You point out a couple of things in your introduction. We should mention that you really give a detailed introduction to each one of these diary excerpts. In the case of this diary by Klaus Langer, you point out, first of all, quite rightly, I think, that part of what perhaps leads to their trouble is that they, in the beginning, are actually rather particular about where they hope to emigrate. And they don't seem to realize the dire straits in which they find themselves, but are trying to be very particular about where can the father find a good job and where can they sustain their standard of living and that sort of thing. And they perhaps recognize too late that they have no choice in the matter. They need to get out wherever and whenever they can, and most of the family, unfortunately, does not.
Right. I mean, I think the thing about Klaus's diary is that it captures in such nuanced and really nuanced terms the real plight, the really tragic plight of the German Jews in particular, who were so assimilated, most of them, and who had been in Germany for so long and so felt themselves a part of German culture and German life. And I mean, Klaus's father was a judge, and they were, you know, of course, very cultured, and, you know, they went to the theater and the opera, and they played musical instruments, and they were very well-read and involved in international, you know, knowledgeable about international politics and et cetera, et cetera. And they simply had no way to understand what was happening to them. They had no precedent for thinking that they would be treated the way, for example, the Jews of Eastern Europe were treated. They did not see themselves in that same light. And so it's very poignant, I think, and I think it's poignant even in broader terms for any minority group that becomes assimilated in a majority culture, that we are always reminded that there's danger, you know, and no matter how comfortable we all may feel, you never know what's going to happen. And it's not really about paranoia. I think it's more just that, you know, the currents, political currents, are so complicated. And I feel there's always this tremendous empathy for Klaus and his family, because I can imagine how they felt, that they just, it was very difficult for them to believe that this was happening to them and to accept it. And so they proceeded, even through the emigration process, as if they were the entitled members of German society that they had always been. And yet they were no longer that, and it was very difficult. And by the time they realized that, with the exception of Klaus, it was too late. They, you know, Klaus's father and his grandmother were not able to get out of Germany as he was.
You also make mention of, in the introduction, and we can read it for ourselves in the diary, the fact that young Klaus, as he thinks about emigrating and, you know, attempts to make arrangements, he's planning for most of the time that he will bring with him his typewriter, his bicycle, mm-hmm. his cello, maybe even the family's grand piano.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is clearly a young man who does not see the full reality of the situation in which he is caught.
Mm-hmm. And again, that part, it's interesting that you're mentioning this, because that diary was extremely difficult for me to write about because of that. Because I didn't want to criticize them or in any way to make it seem that they were stupid or slow or blind or anything, but to say this was their perspective, and it was a perspective that had been granted to them by their life experience. And it's a perspective that any of us can identify with. And so how is it possible for a human being to understand that they're not entitled to the things that they've been entitled to for their entire lives? And so Klaus's plans to take the grand piano are such a wonderful, detailed illustration of that.
It's so poignant and so pathetic.
It is. I mean, he has no way of understanding that he's going to be lucky to escape with the clothes on his back and with his life, let alone bringing along any luxuries or anything that he might, and that his life is never going to be the same. There are not going to be cellos and grand pianos and bicycles in exile, that his life is about to change in a way that he just cannot imagine.
Alexandra Zabruder is author and editor of Salvaged Pages, Young Writer's Diaries of the Holocaust, published by Yale University Press, with a second edition released in 2015. By the way, Alexandra Zabruder is also responsible for another fascinating book called 26 Seconds, A Personal History of the Zabruder Film. Alexandra Zabruder's grandfather, Abraham Zabruder, is the gentleman who took the most famous film footage of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, music. We will preview two orchestra concerts this weekend by the Racine Symphony and the UW Parkside Symphony, and the show about to open at Carthage College called Head Over Heels. Today is going to be mostly sunny and warm with a high of 69 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.